third lecture in this series on Jung, a 20th century wizard. And tonight we're going to talk about Jung and the alchemical renaissance. Alchemy. The word comes from chem, which in Egyptian means the dark earth, and in Greek means Egypt. We find the word chem, or chemistry, in Greek texts dating back to about 300 AD. And in those texts, it's noted as an art of Egypt, of chem, the land of the dark earth. And it was associated with the transmutation of silver and gold, we're told. And in common imagination, this art of alchemy is somehow still linked up with that transmutational mystery, with the changing of base substance into a precious gold. It was the life work of Carl Jung to reveal in this depreciated tradition a noble heritage of the spirit. And in that work, Jung proved himself a true master of transmutations. When last we encountered Carl Gustav, he was lost in Kunstnach amidst many visions. And let me return to that theme. Last week I introduced a bit the transformational process that Jung went through between about 1913 and 1917. It was an intense period of confrontation with what he termed the unconscious, but which we might equally term the supraconscious, a realm outside of common awareness. It was a period of intense journeys, of deep encounters with what we might term an imaginal, a visionary world. Jung kept record of that journey in a book we also mentioned last week called The Red Book. In The Red Book, Jung recorded his discussions, his conversations, his encounters with figures that came directly from this unconscious, imaginal realm. And though we have only a very few pages of the Red Book that have been allowed to reach print, we do have one testimony of the nature of this encounter that comes to us in a little text called the Septem Sermonis Ad Mortuos, Seven Sermons to the Dead. Jung tells the story of how this text came to be. It was in December of 1916. He states that there was an atmosphere of dense spiritual intensity developing, as if spirits were walking in the night through his house. His children started having strange dreams. His son came up with this most extraordinarily strange picture. He said it felt as if the entire world was closing in, as if something was about to burst. And then, one Sunday morning, as they all sat in the parlor, the doorbell rang. Now, this was a real doorbell. You know, the old way where you have a string attached to a bell. The doorbell rang, and they actually saw the bell ring. Jung went to the door, and there was no one there. He opened the door thinking, what in the world is going on? And at that moment, he felt as if a crowd of spirits rushed into the house. Thus began the Seven Sermons to the Dead. Over the next several nights, he was lost in an intense encounter with these presences, as he recalls. And he wrote the Seven Sermons as his response to them. And this is how the Seven Sermons begins. Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, the seven sermons to the dead, written by Basilides in Alexandria, city where east toucheth the west. Sermo 1. The dead came back from Jerusalem, where they found not what they sought. They prayed me, let them in, and besought my word, and thus I began my teaching. Hearken, I begin with nothingness. Nothingness is the same as fullness. In infinity, full is no better than empty. Nothingness is both empty and full. As well might ye say anything of nothingness, as, for instance, white it is, or black, or again it is not, or it is. A thing that is infinite and eternal hath no qualities, since it hath all qualities. This nothingness or fullness we name the Pleroma. Therein both thinking and being cease, since the eternal and infinite process has no qualities. It is no being, for he then would be distinct from the Pleroma, and would possess qualities which would distinguish him as something different from the Pleroma. I'll go on no further, but you get the picture, the tone. He goes on in this text to teach in an emanational psychology. It's sort of a creation myth of the beginning from the Pleroma, a fullness which is emptiness, a thing that has no distinction, no discrimination, descending into discriminated qualities. The second sermon begins with these words. In the night, the dead stood along the wall and cried, we would have knowledge of God. Where is God? Is God dead? And then Jung goes on with his discussion. In the third sermo, like mists arising from a marsh, the dead came near and cried, speak further us concerning the supreme God. Sermo 4, the dead filled the place murmuring and said, tell us of gods and devils, accursed one. And so it goes on to the seventh sermo, which I'll read in its entirety. Yet when night was come, the dead again approached with lamentable mien and said, there is yet one matter we forgot to mention. Teach us about man. Man is a gateway through which from the outer world of gods, demons, and souls ye pass into the inner world, out of the greater into the smaller world. Small and transitory is man. Already is he behind you, and once again ye find yourselves in endless space, in the smaller or innermost infinity. At immeasurable distance standeth one single star in the zenith. This is the one God of this one man. This is his world, his Pleroma, his divinity. In this world is man Abraxas, the creator and the destroyer of his own world. This star is the God and the goal of man. This is his one guiding God. In him goeth man to his rest. Toward him goeth the long journey of the soul after death. In him shineth forth as light all that man bringeth back from the greater world. To this one God man shall pray. Prayer increaseth the light of the star. It casteth a bridge over death. It prepareth life for the smaller world and assuageth the hopeless desires of the greater. When the greater world waxeth cold, burneth the star. Between man and his one God there standeth nothing. So long as man can turn away his eyes from the fiery spectacle of Abraxas. Man here, God there. Weakness and nothingness here. There, eternal creative power. Here, nothing but darkness and chilling moisture. There, holy light. Whereupon the dead were silent, and ascended like the smoke above the herdsman's fire, who through the night kept watch over his flock. So ends the septum, Ceremonies ad Mortos. You get a sense of the types of images coming to you, the types of dialogues he was having. They had actually a, we might say, a religious, a spiritual nature. As he dealt in his imagination, we must understand that he followed a path, which we might call a technique of meditation, of entry into the imagination. And that is, of course, important. But more important is that this path led to a certain location, a locale with a certain type of environment, with certain denizens, with certain images. And these he tried to record in this red book. And as he emphasized later in life, all of his work of later years came from these dreams and visions. As he said, these were the fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. A strange experience it was. But before he could draw conclusions from it, he had in some fashion to assure himself that it was not entirely idiosyncratic, that it was not entirely his alone, his psychosis, his personal madness. What he seemed to contact had a nature that he came to call archetypal, primary forms, primary types, that he felt, sensed, present in the dreams and the psychoses of his patients. He found them, he thought, in the myths of humanity. But were there other human beings who had walked this path voluntarily, encountered these types of images? Where could he find some objective substance upon which to build? When he searched for precedents, first he turned, of course, to ancient Christian Gnosticism. The words, indeed, the images that he uses in the Septum Sermones Ad Mortuos are old Gnostic images, written by Basilides in Alexandria, where East and West meet. Basilides was a Gnostic teacher of Alexandria. Jung had some familiarity with his system, shall we say, his ideas, his own image of creation, based upon writings of the heresiologists, the church fathers who had opposed the heresies of Basilides. The word pleroma, again, comes from Gnostic mythologies. What is this Gnosticism, though? You see, we have a rather monolithic view of Christianity, of the origins of Christianity in our own time, although perhaps that is changing due to recent scholarship, recent discoveries. In the original Christian story, the story we take as basic Orthodox Christianity, humankind, fallen in sin, had by an act of divine grace been saved. A redemptive sacrifice of God, by God, had paid the price of that redemption. Salvation was accomplished. It was a factum, a fact. Now this story, this history, is of course a myth. It is played, however, upon 2,000 years of human history. Human history has eddied around this monolithic story. And its truth has been an affirmation of the belief of two millennia. A vast and complex system of teachings, of dogmas, and theology, of rational explanations and proofs of dogma's validity have come forth from this history story. And in addition to this, there once also existed a legacy of rituals that reflected the myth and symbols that expressed its meaning and sacramental actions that mediated the fact of salvation to the individual psyche experientially. But since the Reformation, with the increasing rationality of modern humankind, that part has fallen away. It is apparent, however, that in early Christianity, there were other voices, that this stone was not, perhaps, the unique cornerstone. In early Christianity, there was a sect called heresy, a group who had an entirely different view of Christianity. In this Gnostic legacy, the Logos, the Christ, came not as a redemptive sacrificial lamb, but as a messenger of the light within life. And in so doing, he brought a message of transformation. Each individual, each Christian, had responsibility to seek and to find that life within themselves that was indeed life. And in so doing, that individual, she and he, became, as the ancient texts say, not a Christian, but a Christ. The saving act was essentially an individual act repeated by each individual. There had been a predating Sophianic tradition, and from that Sophianic tradition we get the very word philosophy, philosophia, a lover of Sophia, of wisdom. In the Sophianic tradition, there had been a vision of a light, feminine in nature, which had descended into creation, into matter. It was here, present. It was the mother of all living. And the finding of that light, the releasing of that light, was a work, was a task. I give to you, for example, of this type, this view of Christianity, words from the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas was discovered in 1945 in the desert of Egypt, along with the Nag Hammadi texts. Present scholarship would date it perhaps earlier than any of the four Gospels we call the canonical Gospels, although there is some discussion on that point, and people of more orthodox inclinations would tend to date it later. The Gospel of Thomas is composed of sayings of the living Jesus. There are 114 of them. The 22nd Logion, or saying, let me read to you. They said to him, "Shall we then, as children, enter the kingdom?" Jesus said to them, "When you make the two one, when you make the inside like the outside, and the outside like the inside, and the above like the below, and when you make male and female one and the same, so that male be not male, nor female female, when you fashion eyes in the place of an eye, and a hand in a place of a hand, and a foot in a place of a foot, and a likeness in a place of a likeness, then you will enter the kingdom." And the 77th saying, or Logion, Jesus said, "It is I who am the light which is above them all. It is I who am the all. From me did the all come forth, and unto me did the all extend. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up the stone, and you will find me." In these texts, there are some words that are important. Make. When you make, an eye in the place of an eye, and a hand in a place of a hand. When you make the male and the female one single thing, when you cleave the wood, you will find me. When you lift the stone, I am there. In these words, these active words, there's a sense of a work to be done. In the Gnostic view, you see, and this perhaps may be subtle, salvation may have been a fact, but it was also a process, a figuration, an action in time taking place within the individual. The work, the action, might be termed an intense psychological process. It is clear that within Gnosticism of the early Christian centuries, it involved an intense imaginative, visionary process, for sure, because we have their texts that stand in witness. It was tied to vision, and from vision, story, myth. And it was in these mythic forms, in the archetypal images revealed in these mythic forms, that Jung found echoes, archetypes, ancient primary images, reminiscent of his own encounter with the deeper levels of the psychic realm. Well, what were these archetypes? How could I summarize them? If in brief moments I were to try to form an image, it would be of a first unformed primary source in Gnostic mythology called the Pleroma. From this single unformed, undifferentiated, there came a differentiation of two. Syzygies, they're called, equals, dyads, opposites. Descending in an outpouring of archetypal form, these syzygies, these dual powers, finally constellated in forms that we might call Sophia and Logos. Sophia, the word itself, means wisdom. Logos, word, verb. Sophia masculine, Logos. Excuse me, Sophia feminine. But we should make the male and the female one. Logos masculine. But in essence, the very point is that this was an androgynous pair in relationship. In the figure of Sophia, Gnostic mythology found a feminine aeon, wisdom, mother of all life, a force, a power indwelling in creation, in cosmos, perhaps even a divine spark captive in its darkness. And in Logos, the masculine aeon, we found a figure reaching out a hand to her, seeking her, seeking to release her, to unify with her, to reform the androgynous whole. A brief recension of the central myth of the old Gnostics. But the tradition was lost to time. Its texts, its testaments were destroyed. It was branded heresy. And the monolithic orthodoxy stood across time. And Jung knew that in Gnosticism he could not find what he sought. There was not enough evidence. Jung's journey between 1913 and 1917 had involved, as I said, a path, a technique of active imagination. And it had involved, most definitely, a destination. The journey along the path had led him to a different world, an underworld, an overworld, an alternative type of reality, a world called unconscious, but equally well called supraconscious. And yet, if he could find no evidence that others had followed this same path and found this same land and its images, its facts. If he could not find the evidence that others too had seen this world, he really could never speak of it. It was his personal madness. From 1920 to about 1926, Jung pursued this quest for the evidence in history of his experience. He had some dreams, actually, at the time that sort of gave an inkling of a thing to come. He dreamt of himself in the 17th century, locked in an old manor house, in a library full of old manuscripts. As he said, exactly the type of library that he himself was to build about 15 years later. And then there arrived a manuscript from a fellow by the name of Richard Wilhelm, a sinologist, a student of China, and of Chinese wisdom, particularly Taoism. Let me just read what Jung said of this. Richard Wilhelm had lived many years in China, and he is the one actually who did probably the most famous translation of the I Ching, some of you may be familiar with. Jung writes, "My deceased friend, Richard Wilhelm, co-author of this book, sent me the text of The Secret of the Golden Flower at a time that was crucial for my own work. This was in 1928. I had been investigating the processes of the collective unconscious since the year 1913 and had obtained results that seemed to me questionable in more than one respect." You should see him saying this tongue in cheek. "I had been investigating the processes of the collective unconscious." Mm-hmm. "Yes, doctor. Indeed you had. And had been obtaining results that seemed to me questionable in more than one respect." Mm, questionable, yes, I see. "They not only lay far beyond everything known to academic psychology, but they also overstepped the bounds of any medical, purely personal psychology. They confronted me with an extensive phenomenology to which hitherto known categories and methods could no longer be applied. My results, based on 15 years of effort, seemed inconclusive because no possibility of comparison offered itself." You see what he's talking about here. He had been through this process. He had had, well, his researches, his visions, his experiences. He had his Red Book. But it seemed entirely questionable and perhaps totally outside the bounds of anything that he could compare it to. "I knew of no realm of human experience with which I might have backed up my findings with some degree of assurance. The only analogies, and these I must say were far removed in time, I found scattered among the reports of the heresiologists," speaking, of course, of the Gnostics. "Considering the fact that a period of no less than 1700 to 1800 years separates us from that age, support from that quarter seemed to me extraordinarily risky." And again, we should remember that this is well before the discovery of the Nag Hammadi Library and other Gnostic texts that have lately become quite famous. Again, the connections were for the most part of a subsidiary nature and left gaps at just the most important points, so that I found it impossible to make use of the Gnostic material. The text that Wilhelm sent me helped me out of this difficulty. It contained exactly those items I had long sought for in vain among the Gnostics. Thus, the text afforded me a welcome opportunity to publish, at least in provisional form, some of the essential results of my investigations. At the same time, it seemed to me a matter of no importance that The Secret of the Golden Flower is not only a Taoist text concerning the Chinese yoga, but is also an alchemical treatise. A deeper study of the Latin treatises has taught me better and has shown me that the alchemical character of the text is of prime significance, though I shall not go into this point more closely here. I would only like to emphasize that it was the text of the Golden Flower that first put me on the right track. Well, this text of the Golden Flower, Secret of the Golden Flower, is a Taoist meditation text. And what Jung found interesting is that this text spoke about both a path and a destination very much like his own path. The text, as Jung says, advises the one seeking to essentially let things happen in the imagination. For example, the text starts with an image. Suppose you are sitting and watching a sunset. Watch the globe of the sun set in the distance. And then close your eyes. Look at the impression left by that globe of light in your vision. And follow into that light. Why? What are you going to see there? Well, that's the point. You won't find out till you go there. Don't go supposing what I will see. Go. The text seemed to be teaching a technique that Jung had been developing for about 10 years called active imagination. It was a technique in which one tried to liberate the imaginal power, the figurative, the fictive power. To let images arise from the unconscious spontaneously, and then to engage them. Consciously bring perspective to the forces, to the images that came from the unconscious. The text, as I say, involved this path, which we might call an opening of the imaginative power, but it also seemed to reach similar destinations. There were images of opposites coming up in this meditative process. And these opposites were seeking conjunctions. After receiving the text of The Secret of the Golden Flower, after writing his commentary, Jung started developing a curiosity about Western alchemy. Of course, there had been one individual in the psychoanalytic movement earlier who had taken this path, a fellow by the name of Silber, who had seen in early alchemical texts the representation of the unconscious finding image. This had been in around 1918 or so, and he had actually given his paper to Freud, who declared it so much, what's the German word? I won't use the English one. Yeah, something like that. And the poor fellow actually ended up committing suicide. There are probably other reasons, but... And Jung was familiar with this early work on alchemy, but it had not really attracted much of his interest. So he put out an order to a Munich bookseller to start collecting alchemical texts for him. And he started receiving these texts, and they actually sat on his table, these 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century manuscripts, for a couple of years before he started entering them. And as he started reading them, he thought, my gosh, by golly, this is really weird. It makes no sense. But as he read on, he started occasionally catching a phrase that seemed to be pointing at something. He just didn't know what it was pointing at. And so he thought perhaps what he needed to do is create a lexicon. And he started taking notes. And when he would encounter a phrase in one text, he would try to interpret what it meant there. And he found the same phrase in another text. He would try to correlate what it was talking about here. He says he worked along philological lines, trying to take the words from the various phrases in which they occurred across the numerous texts and find some sort of coherent meaning. And suddenly, things started to open up. It seemed that these alchemists were involved in a work. They were trying to transform something, for sure. But it became increasingly more apparent to Jung that the work was not necessarily just or ultimately even primarily a physical labor. It seemed that they were working on a transformation of interior psychological nature. I mentioned the Gnostics, the history of a work, a spiritual work of redemption. You know, it wasn't just the Gnostics that had this tradition of a work that needed to be done by humankind. It had existed in other circles, pagan circles, known as Hermetic circles. It had seemed to have found form also in Jewish mysticism of the Merkabah mystics in the 2nd and 3rd century. From the Merkabah mysticism developed in the 12th and 13th century, what we know as Kabbalah, termed by Gershom Scholem, its greatest student and scholar, as a form of Jewish Gnosticism. The work was a redemptive work. There was a sense in these traditions that there was a light in matter, in this world, in the interior of the human, scattered, that somehow needed to be redeemed, needed to be, shall we say, extracted, transmuted, gathered. The tradition existed in Greek and Islamic alchemical texts. The tradition, in another way, existed even in the Sufi tradition. If one looks at Ibn Arabi, the great mystic of the 13th century and father of much of what is now the Sufi tradition, one finds very much an honoring of the imaginal world and the work that comes from the encounter with what he called the imaginal. Of course, our bias is that the imaginal, it's a lie, remember. It's not real. And, of course, only real things are real, and imaginal things, they're lies. But you see, again, there's a duality here in this tradition that must be understood. In the tradition of vision, what was called imaginal, image, symbol, dream, vision, was just as real as the earth, the stone, the wind, the sun. It was a mate. It was a crossing reality. These two, the visionary, the alternative, the spiritual, if you wish to call it such, and the material, were dancing together. You had history, the factum, the fact, the act, the thing done. But each and everything done in time by humankind was touched, inseminated by the vision, by the imaginative forming. The two danced together. And you could not know history without sensing the imposition of that story dancing with it. Alchemy was related to this tradition of vision, dancing with matter. And it is quite interesting that these traditions, the Kabbalistic, the Hermetic, alchemical, even the Christian visionary tradition, even the Gnostic tradition of Christianity, all came together in a giant crossing of ways in the 12th century in the area of the southern Pyrenees, the south of France, and the north of Spain. In a vast coincidence of history, these visionary traditions all crossed ways at that critical point, which I might also say was the approximate date of the birth of our dear friend, the wizard Merlin, that I spoke about in our first lecture. So alchemy, the art of Egypt, the art of the dark earth. There was a myth in alchemy, a tradition of story about the transmutation of matter, a vision of a mystery that resided within matter, within what seemed most gross, most heavy, most dark. There existed a thing of light, a thing golden like the sun, precious beyond value. And this mystery in matter sought by a work, by an alchemical process, to be released. And by that alchemical process, if this magical substance, this gold, this precious thing was released, it in and of itself was transformative. They called it the elixir vitae, the elixir of life, the stone of the philosopher. And if it could be refined from the grossness of matter, that magical substance would transform all that it touched. It was a work, you see. But this work that was developing out of the 12th century in the birth of Western alchemy, was, almost a diametrical opposite, or at least a 90-degree crossing of the work known as the divine work, the Opus Divinum. In Christianity, as I said, there was a work, but it was a salvation that was accomplished in fact. The soul had been saved by the truth and the light of God, the Lumen Dei, the light of God. And it was supported, this divine work, by a rational theology of salvation, by a corpus of Christian dogma that had developed over a millennium. Salvation was done. Believe in him and you are saved. The alchemical work occurring increasingly, in the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th century, turned not from this light above, from the divine light of Christ, but turned to a light that they saw lost in the darkness of matter. It was a work in progress, and the worker of this work was the alchemist. Its concern was not the Lumen Dei, the light of God. It was the Lumen Naturae, the light of nature, a light in nature. And the extraction of that light, that gold, that precious substance was its work. You one must remember that the first alchemists were very much linked also to the healing traditions of the physician. They were concerned with the mystery of the healing of matter. They had inherited the basic outlines of their story from more ancient traditions. Their work was, shall we say, a realization of the story in their own psyches. Now, of course, these alchemists were working with matter, you know. They did have alembics. They had their crucibles. They had their slow, steady flames. They were looking at matter. But, you see, they really didn't understand what they were looking at in the way we scientifically understand matter. How can I explain this? Let me give you a story. You know, if you look at something that is totally dark, what are you going to see? Well, anything you see there, since there's nothing to see outwardly, is probably being projected inwardly. You know, if you put people in a sensory deprivation chamber, float them in warm water, with a snorkel, you know, long enough, they start to hallucinate. They start to see images. There's no screen outwardly to see upon. And so it's the inward that is projected. I remember my own most memorable experience with this. And when I was about 27, I had a month vacation from my internship in surgery. And I decided that I would walk the coast of Wales, which was my ancestral home. So I went to seek out the home of my great-grandfather in a little town called Beth Gellert in North Wales, which I found. And I found lodging there in Beth Gellert. And I took a day trip up north to the coast, to Carnarvon. And it ends up, I found at the end of my day, that the last bus headed south to Beth Gellert, a little village, down a long and small road, had left. So I thought, no problem, I'll hitchhike. Well, I was not having much luck with the old thumb that night. And it kept getting darker and darker. And, you know, in Wales, you can always tell what the weather's going to be, you see, because if you can see the mountains, it's just about to rain. And if you can't see the mountains, it's raining. Well, it was one of those nights where you could just barely see the mountains, and I knew what was coming. The clouds were lowering down. The darkness was coming.